Death found famine in a fish restaurant in Genoa. He had a booth all to himself and was eating duck and dirty rice.
"Oh," said Famine, "it's you."
"Yes, we must ride. You must have got my message."
"Pull up a chair," Famine hissed. "They do a very good alligator sausage here."
"I said we must ride."
"Why?"
Death sat down and explained. Famine listened, although he never stopped eating.
"I see," he said at last. "Thank you, but I think I shall sit this one out."
"Sit it out? You're a horseman."
"Yes, of course. But what is my role here?"
"I beg your pardon?"
"No famine appears to be involved, does it? A shortage of food, per se, as such?"
"Well, no. Not as such, obviously, but..."
"So I would, as it were, be turning up just a wave. No, thank you."
"You used to ride out every time," said Death accusingly.
Famine waved a bone airily.
"We had proper apocalypses in those days," he said, and sucked at the bone. "You could sink your teeth into them."
"Nevertheless, this is the end of the world."
Famine pushed his plate aside and opened the menu.
"There are other worlds," he said. "You're too sentimental, Death. I've always said so."
Death drew himself up. Humans had created famine, too. Oh, there had always been droughts and locusts. But for a really good famine, for fertile land to be turned into a dust bowl by stupidity and avarice, you needed humans. Famine was arrogant.
"I am sorry," he said, "to have trespassed on your time."
He went outside, into the crowded street, all alone. The stick swooped down towards the plains and levelled off a few hundred feet above the ground.
"We're on our way now," shouted Lutze, pointing ahead.
Lobsang looked down at a slim wooden tower hung with complicated boxes. There was another one in the far distance, a toothpick in the morning mist.
"Semaphore towers," Lutze shouted. "Ever seen them?"
"Only in the city,"
Lobsang shouted above the slipstream.
"It's the Grand Trunk,"
the sweeper shouted back.
"Runs like an arrow all the way to the city. All we have to do is follow it."
Lobsang clung on. There was no snow beneath them, and it looked as though spring was well advanced. And therefore it was unfair that here, that much nearer the sun, the air was frigid and was being driven into his flesh by the wind of their travel.
"It's very cold up here." "Yes, did I tell you about the double-knit combinations?"
"Yes."
"I've got a spare pair in my sack. You can have them when we stop."
"Your own personal pair?"
"Yes, second best, but well darned."
"No, thank you."
"They've been washed."
"Lutze?"
"Yes?"
"Why can't we slice when we're on this thing?"
The tower was well past them. The next one was pencil-sized already. The black and white shutters on the boxes were twinkling in the sunlight.
"Do you know what happens if you slice time on a magically powered vehicle travelling at more than 70 miles an hour?"
"No?"
"Me neither, and I don't want to find out."
Tick.
Igor opened the door before the second knock. An Igor might be filling coffins with earth in the cellar, or up on the roof adjusting the lightning conductor, but a caller never had to knock twice.
"Lady Thep,"
he muttered, nodding his head. He looked blankly at the six figures behind her.
"We have called to inspect progress," said Lady Lejean.
"And these ladies and gentlemen, Lady Thep?"
"My associates,"
said her ladyship, matching Igor's blank stare.
"If you would be so kind as to step inside, I will see if the master is in,"
said Igor, observing the convention that a true butler never knows the whereabouts of anyone in the house until they decide they want it to be known. He backed through the door into the workshop and then lurched into the kitchen, where Jeremy was calmly pouring a spoonful of medicine down the sink.
"That woman is here," he said, "and she hath brought lawyers."
Jeremy held out a hand, palm downwards, and examined it critically. "You see, Igor," he said, "here we are, almost at the completion of our great work, and I remain absolutely calm. You could build a house on my hand, it is so steady."
"Lawyers, sir,"
said Igor, giving the word some extra spin.
"And?"
"Well, we have a lot of money,"
said Igor, with the conviction of a man who has informally secreted a small but sensible amount of gold in his own bag.
"And we have finished the clock,"
said Jeremy, still watching his hand.
"We've been nearly finished for days,"
said Igor darkly.
"If it wasn't for her, I reckon we could have caught that thunderstorm 2 days ago."
"When's the next one?" Igor screwed up his face and banged his temple a couple of times with the palm of his hand.
"Unsettled conditions, with a low approaching from the rim," he said. "Can't promise anything with the soppy weather you get here. Ha! Back home the thunderstorms come running as soon as they see you put up the iron pole. So what do you want me to do about the lawyers?"
"Show them in, of course. We have nothing to hide."
"Are you sore, sir?"
said Igor, whose carpet bag couldn't be lifted with one hand.
"Please do it, Igor."
Jeremy smoothed down his hair while the grumbling Igor disappeared into the shop and returned with the guests.
"Lady Lejeune, sir, and some other people," said Igor.
"It's good to see you, your ladyship," said Jeremy, smiling glassily. He vaguely remembered something he had read. "Won't you introduce me to your friends?"
Lady Lejeune gave him a nervous look. Oh yes, humans always needed to know names, and he was smiling again. It made it so hard to think.
"Mr. Jeremy, these are my associates," she said. "Mr. Black, Mr. Green, Miss Brown, Miss White, Miss Yellow, and Mr. Blue."
Jeremy held out his hand.
"I'm pleased to meet you," he said.
Six pairs of eyes looked uncomprehendingly at the hand.
"The custom here is to shake hands," said her ladyship.
In unison, the auditors extended a hand and wiggled it slowly in the air.
"The hand of the other person," said her ladyship.
She gave Jeremy a thin-lipped smile.
"They are foreigners," she said.
And she recognized the panic in their eyes, even if they didn't. "We can count the number and types of atom in this room," they were thinking. "How can there be anything in here we cannot understand?" Jeremy managed to catch one wavering hand in his.
"And you are Mr.—"
The auditor turned worried eyes on Lady Lejeune.
"Mr. Black," she said.
"I understood that we were Mr. Black,"
said another male-shaped auditor.
"No, you are Mr. Green."
"Nevertheless, we would prefer Mr. Black. We are the senior, and Black is a more significant shade. We do not wish to be Mr. Green."
"The translation of your names is not, I think, important," said Lady Lejeune.
She gave Jeremy another smile.
"They are my accountants," she added,
some reading on her part having suggested that this might excuse most oddities.
"You see, Igor," said Jeremy, "they are simply accountants."
Igor grimaced. Where his baggage was concerned, accountants were probably worse news than lawyers.
"Grey would be acceptable," said Mr. Green. "Nevertheless, you are Mr. Green. We are Mr. Black. It is a matter of status."
"If that is the case," said Miss White, "white is higher status than black. Black is absence of color."
"The point is valid," said Mr. Black. "Therefore we are now Mr. White. You are Miss Red."
"You previously indicated that you were Mr. Black."
"New information indicates a change of position. This does not indicate incorrectness of said previous position."
"It's happening already," thought Lady Lejeune. "It's in the darkness where your eyes can't see. The universe becomes two halves, and you live in the half behind the eyes. Once you have a body, you have a me. I have seen galaxies die. I have watched atoms dance. But until I had the dark behind the eyes, I didn't know the death from the dance. And we were wrong. When you pour water into a jug, it becomes jug-shaped, and it is not the same water any more. An hour ago, they never dreamed of having names, and now they're arguing about them. And they can't hear what I think." She wanted more time. The habits of a billion years don't yield entirely to a mouthful of bread, and she could see that a crazy life-form like humanity should not be allowed to exist. Yes, indeed, certainly, Of course. But she wanted more time. They should be studied. Yes, studied. There should be reports. Yes, reports. Full reports. Long, long, full reports. Caution. That was it. That was the word. Auditors loved that word. Always put off until tomorrow something that tomorrow you could always put off until, well, let's say, next year. It has to be said that Lady Lejeune was not herself at this point. She didn't quite have a grip of herself to be. The other six auditors, in time, yes, they'd think the same way. But there wasn't time. If only she could persuade them to eat something, that would... Yes, that would bring them to their senses. There seemed to be no food around, though. She could see a very large hammer on the bench. "How is progress, Mr. Jeremy?" she said, walking over to the clock. Igor moved very fast and stood almost protectively next to the glass pillar. Jeremy hurried forward. "We have carefully aligned all the systems."
"Again?" Igor growled.
"Yes, again.
Several times, in fact," Igor added.
"And now we simply await the right weather conditions." "But I thought you stored lightning." Her ladyship indicated the greenish glass cylinders bubbling and hissing along the wall of the workshop. Just by the bench with, yes, the hammer on it. And no one could read her thoughts. The power. "There will easily be enough to keep the mechanism working, but to start the clock will require what Igor calls a jump," said Jeremy. Igor held up two crocodile clips the size of his head.
"Right," he said. "But you hardly ever get the right kind of thunderstorms down here. Sort of built this in Oberwald, I kept saying."
"What is the nature of this delay?" said, possibly, Mr. White. "We need a thunderstorm, sir, for the lightning," said Jeremy. Lady Lejeune stepped back a little closer to the bench.
"Well, arrange one," said Mr. White.
"Huh! Well, if we were in Oberwald, of course."
"It is merely a matter of pressures and potentials," said Mr. White. "Can you not simply create one?"
Igor gave him a look of disbelief mixed with respect.
"You're not from Oberwald, are you?" he said.
Then he gasped and banged the side of his head.
"Hey, I felt that one," he said. "Whoops! How did you do that? Press her dropping like a stone."
Sparks glittered along his black fingernails. He beamed.
"I'll just go and raise the lightning rod," he said, hurrying to a pulley system on the wall.
Lady Lejeune turned on the others. This time she wished they could read her thoughts. She didn't know enough pronounceable human swear words.
"That is against the rules," she hissed.
"Mere expediency," said Mr. White. "If you had not been lax, this would have been concluded by now."
"I counselled further study."
"Unnecessary."
"Is there a problem?" said Jeremy, in the diffident voice he used for conversations not involving clocks.
"The clock should not be started yet,"
said Lady Lejeune, not taking her eyes off the other auditors.
"But you asked me. We've been... It's all set up. There may be problems. I think we should see another week of testing."
But there weren't problems, she knew. Jeremy had built the thing as if he'd built a dozen like it before. It had been all Lady Lejeune could do to spin things out this long, especially with Igor watching her like a hawk.
"What is your name, young person?" said Mr. White to Jeremy.
The clockmaker backed away. "Jeremy," he said, "and I don't understand, Mr. White. A clock tells the time. A clock isn't dangerous. How could a clock be a problem? It's a perfect clock."
"Then start it."
"But, Her Ladyship," the door knocker thundered. "Igor!"
"Yes, sir,"
said Igor from the hallway.
"How did the servant person get there?" said Mr. White, still watching Her Ladyship.
"It's a sort of trick they have," said Jeremy. I'm sure it's only..."
"It's Dr. Hopkins, sir," said Igor, entering from the hall. "I told him you were busy, but..."
But Dr. Hopkins, although apparently as mild-mannered as milk, was also a guild official, and had survived as such for several years. Ducking under Igor's arm was no problem at all for a man who could handle a meeting of clockmakers, no two of whom exactly ticked in time with the rest of humanity.
"I just happened to have business this way," he began, smiling brightly, "and it was no trouble to drop in at the apothecary to pick up... Oh, you have company."
Igor grimaced, but there was the code to think of.
"Thal I make some tea, Thar," he said, as all the auditors glared at the doctor.
"What is this tea?"
Mr. White demanded.
"It is a protocol," snapped Lady Lejeune.
Mr. White hesitated. Protocol was important.
Yes, said Jeremy. "Tea, Igor, please, please."
"My word, I see you finished your clock,"
said Dr. Hopkins, apparently oblivious of an atmosphere that could float iron.
"What a magnificent piece of work."
The auditors stared at one another as the doctor ambled past them and looked up at the glass face.
"Well done indeed, Jeremy," he said, removing his glasses and polishing them enthusiastically. "And what is this pretty blue glow?"
It's the crystal ring," said Jeremy.
It spins light," said Lady Lejeune, "and then it makes a hole in the universe."
"Really?"
said Dr. Hopkins, putting his glasses back on.
"What an original idea!
Does a cuckoo come out?"
Tick.
Of the very worst words that can be heard by anyone high in the air, the pair known as "uh-oh" possibly combined the maximum of bowel-knotting terror with the minimum wastage of breath. When Lutze uttered them, Lobsang didn't need a translation. He'd been watching the clouds for some time. They were getting blacker and thicker and darker.
"The handle's tingling!" shouted Lutze. "That's because there's a storm right above us!" screamed Lobsang. "The sky was as clear as a bell a few minutes ago!"
Ankh-Morpork was much closer now. Lobsang could make out some of the taller buildings and see the river snaking across the plain, but the storm was coming up all around the city.
"I'm going to have to land this thing while I can," Lutze said. "Hold on!"
The stick dropped until it was a few feet above the cabbage fields. The plants were a rushing green blur inches below Lobsang's sandals. Lobsang heard another word that, while not the worst you can hear while airborne, is not at all good when it's said by the person steering.
"Do you know how to stop this?" screamed Lobsang. "Not in so many words!" shouted Lutze. "Hold on, I'm going to try something."
The stick tilted up, but kept moving in the same direction. The bristles dipped into the cabbages. It took the width of a field to slow down, at the end of a furrow, with the smell that only squashed cabbage leaves can yield.
"How fine can you slice time?"
the sweeper said, scrambling over the battered plants.
"I'm pretty good," Lobsang began.
"Get better, quick!"
Lutze faded to blue as he ran towards the city. Lobsang caught him up within 100 yards, but the sweeper was still fading, still slicing time thinner and thinner. The apprentice gritted his teeth and followed, straining every muscle. The old man might be a fraud when it came to fighting, but there was no kidding here. The world went from blue to indigo to an inky, unnatural darkness like the shadow of an eclipse. This was deep time. You couldn't stay there long, he knew. Even if you could tolerate the ghastly chill, there were parts of the body that just weren't designed for this. Go too far down, too, and you'd die if you came back too quickly. He hadn't seen it, of course, no apprentice had, but there were some quite graphic drawings in the classrooms. A man's life could become very, very painful if his blood began to move through time faster than his bones. It would also be very short.
"I can't keep this up!"
he panted, running after Lutze in the violet gloom.
"You can!" gasped the sweeper. "You're fast, right?" "I'm not trained for this!"
The city was getting closer.
"No one's trained for this," growled Lutze. "You do it, and you find out that you're good at it." "What happens if you find out you're no good?" said Lobsang.
The going felt easier now. He no longer had the feeling that his skin was trying to drag itself off him.
"Dead men don't find things out," said Lutze.
He turned his head to his apprentice, and his evil grin was a yellow-toothed curve in the shadows.
"Getting the hang?" he added.
I'm on top of it."
"Right. Then, now that we've warmed up..."
To Lobsang's horror, the sweeper faded further into the dark. He called up reserves he knew he didn't have. He screamed at his liver to keep up, thought that he felt his brain creak, and plunged on. The shape of Lutze lightened as Lobsang drew level with him in time.
"Still here? One last effort, lad."
"I can't. You bloody well can."
Lobsang gulped freezing air and fell onwards, where the light was suddenly a calm, pale blue, and Lutse was trotting gently between the frozen carts and unmoving people around the city's gate.
"See? Nothing to it," said the sweeper. "Just maintain, that's all. Nice and steady."
It was like balancing on a wire. It was fine if you didn't think about it.
"But all the scrolls say you go blue and violet and into the black, and then you hit the wall," said Lobsang.
"Ah, well, scrolls," said Lutse,
and left it there, as if the tone of the voice said it all.
"This is Zimmerman's Valley, lad. It helps if you know it's here. The abbot said it's something to do with, what was it? Oh, yeah, boundary conditions. Something like the foam on the tide. We're right on the edge, boy.
But I can breathe easily."
"Yeah, shouldn't happen. Keep moving about, though, otherwise you'll exhaust all the good air round your body field. Good old Zimmerman, eh? One of the best he was. And he reckoned there was another dip even closer to the wall, too."
"Did he ever find it?"
"Don't think so."
"Why?"
"The way he exploded gave me a hint." "Don't worry. You can maintain the slice easily here. You don't have to think about it. You've got other things to think about. Keep an eye on those clouds."
Lobsang looked up. Even in this blue-on-blue landscape, the clouds over the city looked ominous.
"It's what happened back in Oberwald," said Lutse. "The clock needs a lot of power. The storm blew up out of nowhere."
"But the city's huge. How can we find a clock here?"
"First, we're going to head for the centre," said Lutse.
"Why?"
"Because, with luck, we won't have to run so far when the lightning strikes, of course."
"Sweeper, no one can outrun lightning." Lutse spun round and grabbed Lobsang by the robe, dragging him closer.
"Then tell me where to run, speedy boy," he shouted. "There's more to you than meets the third eye, lad. No apprentice should be able to find Zimmerman's Valley. It takes hundreds of years of training, and no one shall be able to make the spinners sit up and dance to his tune the very first time he sees them. Think I'm daft, do you? Orphan boy, strange power, what the hell are you? The Mandala knew you. Well, I'm just a mortal human, and what I know is I'll be damned if I'll see the world shattered a second time. So, help me. Whatever it is you've got, I need it now. Use it."
He let go and stood back. A vein in his bald head was throbbing.
"But I don't know what I can do to..." "Find out what you can do!"
"Tick. Protocol. Rules. Precedent. Ways of doing things. That's how we've always worked," thought Lady Lejeune. "This and this must follow that. It has always been our strength. I wonder if it can be a weakness." If looks could have killed, Dr. Hopkins would have been a smear on the wall. The auditors watched his every move like cats watching a new species of mouse. Lady Lejeune had been incarnate much longer than the others. Time can change a body, especially when you've never had one before. She wouldn't have stared and fumed. She would have clubbed the doctor to the ground. What was one more human? She realized, with some amazement, that the thought there was a human thought. But the other six were still wet behind the ears. They hadn't yet realized the dimensions of duplicity that you needed to survive as a human being. They clearly found it hard to think inside the little dark world behind the eyes, too. Auditors reached decisions in concert with thousands, millions of other auditors. Sooner or later, they'd learn to be their own thinkers, though. It might take a while, because they'd try to learn from one another first. At the moment, they were watching Igor's tea tray with great suspicion.
"Drinking tea is protocol," said Lady Lejeune.
"Is this correct?" Mr. White barked at Dr. Hopkins.
"Oh, yes," said the doctor. "With a ginger biscuit, usually," he added hopefully.
"A ginger biscuit?" replied Mr. White. "A biscuit of red-brown colouring?"
"Yes, sir," said Igor.
He nodded to the plate on his tray.
"I would like to try a ginger biscuit,"
volunteered Miss Red.
"Oh, yes," thought Lady Lejeune. "Please try the ginger biscuits."
"We do not eat or drink," snapped Mr. White.
He gave Lady Lejeune a look of deep suspicion.
"It could cause incorrect ways of thinking."
"But it is the custom," said Lady Lejeune. "To ignore protocol is to draw attention."
Mr. White hesitated, but he was a quick adapter.
"It is against our religion," he said.
"Correct."
It was an amazing leap. It was inventive.
And he'd come up with it all alone. Lady Lejeune was impressed. The auditors had tried to understand religion, because so much that made no sense whatsoever was done in its name. But it could also excuse practically any kind of eccentricity. Genocide, for example. By comparison, a lack of tea-drinking was easy.
"Yes, indeed," said Mr. White, turning to the other auditors. "Is that not true?"
"Yes, that is not true, indeed," said Mr. Green.
"Ooh," said Dr. Hopkins. "I did not know there was any religion that forbade tea."
"Indeed," said Mr. Green. Lady Lejeune could almost feel his mind racing. "It is a... yes, it is a drink of the... correct. It is a drink of the extremely bad, negatively regarded god. It is a... correct. It is a commandment of our religion to... yes, to shun ginger biscuits also." There was sweat on his forehead. For an auditor, this was genius-level creativity. "Also," he went on slowly, as if reading the words off some page invisible to everyone else, "our religion, correct, our religion... demands that the clock be started now, for who may know when the hour may be?" Despite herself, Lady Lejeune nearly applauded.
"Who indeed?" said Dr. Hopkins.
I absolutely agree," said Jeremy, who had been staring at Lady Lejeune. "I don't understand who you... why there's all this fuss. I don't understand why... oh, dear, I'm having a headache."
Dr. Hopkins spilled his tea because of the speed with which he got up and reached into his coat pocket.
"Ah, it so happens I was passing the apothecary on my way here," he began, all in one breath. "I feel it's not the time to start the clock," said Lady Lejeune, edging herself along the desk. The hammer was still invitingly there. "I'm seeing those little flashes of light, Dr. Hopkins," said Jeremy urgently, staring into the middle distance.
"Not the flashes of light, not the flashes of light," said Dr. Hopkins.
He grabbed a teaspoon off Igor's tray, stared at it, threw it over his shoulder, tipped the tea out of a cup, opened the bottle of blue medicine by smashing the top off on the edge of the bench, and poured a cupful, spilling quite a lot of it in his hurry. The hammer was inches away from her ladyship's hand. She didn't dare look round, but she could sense it there. While the auditors stared at the trembling Jeremy, she let her fingers walk across the bench. She wouldn't even have to move. A brisk overarm throw should do it. She saw Dr. Hopkins try to put the cup to Jeremy's lips. The boy put his hands over his face and elbowed the cup out of the way, spilling the medicine across the floor. Then Lady Lejeune's fingers were grasping the handle. She brought her hand round and hurled the hammer directly at the clock. Tick! The war was going badly for the weaker side. Their positioning was wrong, their tactics ragged, their strategy hopeless. The Red Army advanced across the whole front, dismembering the scurrying remnant of the collapsing army. There was room for only one anthill on this lawn. Death found War down among the grass blades. He admired attention to detail. War was in full armour, too, but the human heads he normally had tied to his saddle had been replaced by ant heads, feelers and all.
"Do they notice, do you think?" he said.
"Oh, I doubt it," said War. "Nevertheless, if they did... I'm sure they would appreciate it."
"Ha! Only decent theatre of war around these days," said War. "That's what I like about ants. The buggers don't learn, what?"
"It has been rather peaceful of late, I agree," said Death.
"Peaceful?" said War. "Ha! I may as well change my name to Police Action or Negotiated Settlement. Remember the old days? Warriors used to froth at the mouth. Arms and legs bouncing in all directions. Great times, eh?"
He leaned across and slapped Death on the back.
"I'll bag 'em and you tag 'em, what?"
This looked hopeful, Death thought.
"Talking of the old days," he said carefully, "I'm sure you remember the tradition of riding out."
War gave him a puzzled look.
"Mine's a blank on that one, old boy."
"I sent out the call."
"Can't say it rings a bell."
"Apocalypse," said Death. "End of the world."
War continued to stare.
"Definitely knocking, old chap, and no one's home. And talking of home..."
War looked around at the twitching remains of the recent slaughter. "Spot of lunch?" Around them the forest of grass grew shorter and smaller, until it was indeed no more than grass, and became the lawn outside a house. It was an ancient longhouse. Where else would War live? But Death saw ivy growing over the roof. He remembered when War would never have allowed anything like that, and a little worm of worry began to gnaw. War hung up his helmet as he entered, and once he would have kept it on. And the benches around the fire pit would have been crowded with warriors, and the air would have been thick with beer and sweat. "Brought an old friend back here," he said. Mrs. War was preparing something on the modern black iron kitchen range, which, Death saw, had been installed in the fire pit, with shiny pipes extending into the hole in the roof. She gave Death the kind of nod a wife gives a man whom her husband has, despite previous warnings, unexpectedly brought back from the pub.
"We are having rabbit,"
she said, and added in the voice of one who has been put upon and will extract payment later,
"I'm sure I can make it stretch to 3.
War's big red face wrinkled.
"Do I like rabbit?"
"Yes, dear."
"I thought I liked beef."
"No, dear, beef gives you wind."
"Huh," War sighed. "Any chance of onions?"
"You don't like onions, dear."
"I don't."
"Because of your stomach, dear."
"Huh."
War smiled awkwardly at Death.
"It's rabbit," he said. "Dear, do I ride out for apocalypses?"
Mrs. War took the lid off a saucepan and prodded viciously at something inside.
"No, dear," she said firmly. "You always come down with a cold."
"I thought I rather, sort of liked that kind of thing."
"No, dear, you don't."
Despite himself, Death was fascinated. He had never come across the idea of keeping your memory inside someone else's head.
"Perhaps I would like a beer,"
War ventured.
"You don't like beer, dear?"
"I don't."
"Now it brings on your trouble."
"How do I feel about brandy?"
"You don't like brandy, dear. You like your special oat drink with the vitamins."
"Oh, yeah," said War mournfully. "I'd forgotten I liked that."
He looked sheepishly at Death.
"It's quite nice," he said.
"Could I have a word with you," said Death, "in private?"
War looked puzzled.
"Do I like work?"
"In private, please,"
Death thundered. Mrs. War turned and gave Death a disdainful look.
"I understand, I quite understand," she said haughtily, "but don't you dare say anything to bring on his acid. That's all I shall say."
Mrs. War had been a Valkyrie once, Death remembered. It was another reason to be extremely careful on the battlefield.
"You've never been tempted by the prospect of marriage, old man?"
said War, when she'd gone.
"No, absolutely not. In no way."
"Why not?"
Death was nonplussed. It was like asking a brick wall what it thought of dentistry. As a question, it made no sense.
"I have been to see the other two," he said, ignoring it. "Famine doesn't care, and pestilence is frightened."
"The two of us against the auditors," said War.
"Right is on our side."
"Speaking as War," said War, "I'd hate to tell you what happens to very small armies that have right on their side."
"I have seen you fight."
"My old right arm isn't what it was," War murmured.
"You are immortal. You are not ill," said Death.
But he could see the worried, slightly hunted look in War's eyes, and knew that there was only one way this was going to go. To be human was to change, Death realized. The horsemen were horsemen. Men had wished upon them a certain shape, a certain form. And just like the gods, and the Tooth Fairy, and the Hogfather, their shape had changed them. They would never be human, but they had caught aspects of humanity as though they were some kind of disease. Because the point was that nothing had one aspect and one aspect alone. Men would envisage a being called Famine, but once they gave him arms and legs and eyes, that meant he had to have a brain. That meant he'd think. And a brain can't think about plagues of locusts all the time. Emergent behaviour again. Complications always crept in. Everything changed.
"Thank goodness," thought Death, "that I am completely unchanged and exactly the same as I ever was."
And then there was one.
Tick!